My Govanin, welcome to the Tolkien Lore Channel. I'm the Tolkien Geek, and in this video, I am responding to a Patreon request from Robert Kindling to discuss similarities between the Valar and the Greek Pantheon. And to be clear, when I say the Greek Pantheon, I'm talking about what most people think of when they mean by that, the Olympians mainly, plus Hades, who is technically not an Olympian. So, I'm not going to be discussing all the various gods and demigods that don't count, like, among the main group, because there's just way too many in Greek mythology to go there. So, we're going to look at the similarities here, see what, if anything, might be inspiration for Tolkien's work in Greek mythology, but also some really significant differences. And there's plenty of them, but there are, you know, some similarities that are interesting. So let's get started. And we might as well start at the top of the hierarchy, as it were. We have Manwë on the one hand, who is the elder king of Arda, and we have Zeus, who is the, if you had to pick one single Greek deity who was kind of the boss of everybody else, Zeus would be it. Technically speaking, in Greek mythology, Zeus is one of three kind of co-rulers of everything, because Zeus ends up with the sky, Poseidon ends up with the sea, and Hades ends up with the underworld, and they're kind of like ruling their own domains. But Zeus is kind of the biggest, baddest one of the bunch, and, you know, if you had to pick one, it would be him. And he kind of matches up with Manwë neatly in the sense that both of them seem kind of sky-related. Zeus's big thing is lightning, obviously, whereas Manwë's is the wind. And those both seem kind of very sky-focused. But they're very different in a lot of ways. Manwë is very much a, well, let's just say his idea of being the god of the winds and that sort of thing makes him very associated with birds, which is not really a Zeus thing. But also, he's called the Lord of the Breath of Arda, or the, you know, that kind of thing. And if you look at this from a Christian point of view, breath and spirit are really the same thing, which kind of makes Manwë the Lord of the Spirit of Arda, which is interesting to think about when you think about the fact that Eru brings the world into existence by giving it the flame imperishable, which is very much Tolkien's analog to the Holy Spirit, or at least it seems very clear to me that that's what that is. So Manwë seems very connected to life in that way, whereas Zeus is, you know, the god of lightning, which, yeah, it doesn't really give life a lot. It mostly destroys stuff. Which is not to say that Zeus is just some destructive chaos god or anything like that, but it's a very different kind of connection. I mean, the seeming similarity that they're both very sky-related is a very surface-level look at them. It has to be said, though, that in Greek mythology, Zeus, and let me just give my disclaimer up front here, a lot of what I'm saying is coming from either memory of reading Greek myths a long time ago or refreshing myself recently with Wikipedia. So, you know, I didn't have time to dive into a tome analyzing Greek mythology hugely. So, you know, if I get anything wrong from a technical point of view, I apologize. But according to Wikipedia, at least, Zeus is also the god of law and order in Greek mythology, which sounds about right to me, based on memory. Certainly he's, you know, not against law and order. Like I said, he's not really a chaos god. So the fact that he's wielding lightning, which is a destructive thing, is, yeah, that's a thing, but it's not like he's just destroying stuff willy-nilly either. And in that connection, he is kind of similar to Manwë, because being the elder king and, you know, trying to maintain order, that makes him kind of like a law and order type of figure as well. Although, I don't know that I would call Manwë a god of law and order exactly. That is kind of his role, but it's not his specialty, as it were, in the way that you think of it like this. where we get some pretty early distinctions is when we look at the spouses of Manwë and Zeus. And Manwë's spouse is Varda, who is really just the goddess of light and the stars in particular. Hera is more the goddess of mothers, family, you know, childbearing. She protects women in childbearing, this kind of thing. So Hera being the kind of the queen of Olympus is kind of like a queen of queens, right? I mean, like, her role is quintessentially maternal and female. Varda is not so much that. Varda is interestingly paired with Manwë, if we think of Manwë in that sense of being the lord of the breath or the spirit of Arda. Varda is light, which, again, if you look at Christian theology, light is very much something associated with God, just like spirit and life is. So pairing them together from a Christian point of view makes a lot of sense. But Varda is not just some maternal queen figure. She is very much just kind of her own thing, who happens to be the spouse of the king. So it's kind of interesting that we get this really huge divergence, really kind of up front in a way. And, well, there's more aspects of that that I'll get to later, because when I get through all of these individually, I'm going to look at kind of like the overall look at them and give an idea of how each group compares to the other in certain ways. So I'll leave that for later. But again, here we get an interesting look at, you know, the way that Tolkien, in some ways, if you just start at the top of the hierarchy, as it were, and work your way down, the first one looks kind of similar, but then you immediately get this radical difference. Now, in terms of hierarchy, the next one down might be Ulmo in, you know, the Silmarillion terms. And Poseidon would be a nice, you know, comparison to Ulmo. And this is where we get really the strongest comparison, because they're both basically the Lord of the Waters, you know. Ulmo is certainly very water-focused, and it goes from oceans to lakes to rivers to everything. It's just all the water. Clouds, even. Poseidon is not so much that, but it's basically the same, because he's still, you know, the king of the seas. I'm not sure how much that really affects in things like the rivers and whatnot, and I definitely don't think it has anything to do with the clouds. So, Poseidon is more a ruler of a realm, whereas Ulmo is an elementally connected, you know, creative force. Ulmo created, like, water was his contribution to the music of the Ainur. That was his idea. And so that includes clouds, snow, rain, anything water. So Ulmo is kind of the lord of the deeps, but that's really mainly because he created all the water. Or, you know, water was his idea, let's say, not created in the sense of brought it out of nothing, because Eru did that ultimately. But he's the one who really came up with the idea of water. And so all water is related to Ulmo in some way or another. Not so much for Poseidon, but this is one of the closest connections that we get. And Ulmo, kind of like Poseidon, doesn't really stick around in Valinor or Olympus all the time. He's got, you know, he stays in the seas for the most part, which is, you know, Poseidon is kind of counted as an Olympian, I think, but he really lives more in the ocean and only really comes to Olympus when there's a reason to. And Ulmo is very similar to that. One interesting difference when I was looking at the Wikipedia page for Poseidon is that apparently he's also connected to horses for some reason. I'm not really sure I get that. Greek mythology, of course, is a very, it's not as systematic as we might tend to think of it in modern times. You know, it's not like Greek mythology is a systematic theology of, you know, how each element is controlled by some god. There's a lot of weird different connections because it kind of all grew up bottom up and kind of coalesced. It's not like it started as just this one thing that somebody was like, well, let's think about how, you know, all these different things are connected to particular gods, and somebody was just like, water and horses. No. I don't think that's how that worked. But I just found it really interesting that Ulmo is all about water, and Poseidon we usually think of as all about water, but then horses. Okay, sure, fine. Moving on. Now, in terms of the Greek mythology, of course, I've already talked about Zeus and Poseidon, and then the third of the triad is Hades. Hades rules the underworld. And in that connection, he seems a lot like Mondos, who is, the Lord of the Halls of the Dead. And that's really where the similarity ends. Hades really doesn't have anything else going for him. I mean, that's basically his job. He rules the underworld. He doesn't really let anybody out, and he doesn't, do much else but keep people there. Mondos is much more than just the guy who runs the place where dead people go. He is also a kind of a final judge and arbiter, but he's also the guy who knows everything. Not quite everything, because in the Silmarillion it tells us that he knows everything that has happened, he remembers everything, and he knows everything that will happen except the things that are still in the Freedom of Iluvatar. So he knows basically everything. We don't get the idea that Hades is quite like that. But there is in Greek mythology something that's kind of similar because we have the fates, the three fates. Clotho, I forget the names of all three of them. One of them is Clotho and Lachesis, and I can't remember the third one. But they kind of determine like the lifespan of people. They have these threads, and the thread gets, cut at some point when that's, the end of that person's life. If you've seen the Disney movie Hercules, you get a little bit of this, and in that movie, at least, they are associated with Hades, at least a little bit. So we have some of that kind of dynamic going on, and you could connect that a little bit with Mondos in some weird way, but it's really more connected with Vyrae, and I'll get to her in a minute. But Mondos is also the doomsman of the Valar. He pronounces judgments, but he does it only at the say so of Manwë. Manwë, will basically say, "Mondos, we need a judgment," and Mondos will give the judgment, which is kind of interesting. It makes sense in a way that the guy who presides over what you might call the final fate of, all incarnate beings. Well, not all incarnate beings, because that would include animals, but at least, like humans, elves, that sort of thing. It makes a certain amount of sense that he also is the one who gets to pronounce all the judgments, even though it's not necessarily always connected with people dying. It has a certain fittingness to it. But again, this is kind of different from Hades, who's just literally the guy who runs the place where the dead people are. One interesting connection also between Mondos and Hades, which is nothing to do so much with who they are, but just a story that kind of fits with both of them. The Baron and Luthien story is interesting because when Luthien comes to the halls of Mondos, she sings this beautiful song which moves even Mondos to pity, who never gets moved to pity. Orpheus, when he comes looking for his deceased in Hades, also sings a really nice song and moves, and I think it's not so much Hades, but Persephone to pity, and she moves Hades to release Orpheus's love. So it's different in the sense that, one of them it's the man going in, and the other one it's the woman who gets. But the point is, they both have this story of, the one person who kind of made a crack in the blank facade, so to speak, of, nope, we're just doing our job here. So that was kind of an interesting note to make, and I don't know how much of that would have been like a direct influence on Tolkien, but certainly it seems hard to imagine that it had no impact on the Luthien story. All right, now it starts getting harder to really make a lot of direct connections because the remaining Greek gods and Valar have very few direct one-to-one comparisons, at least that are really easy. There is Yavanna, who is kind of the person in the Silmarillion who is connected with growing things that aren't animals, you know, plants and trees and all that kind of stuff. And in that regard, she is probably pretty comparable to Demeter, who is kind of the god of agriculture, the goddess of agriculture and earth, the fertility of the earth itself, that sort of thing. And so those two are pretty well connected. And that's, you know, there's not really a whole lot else to either of them. Yavanna is a big thing in the Silmarillion because she brings forth the two trees. I don't think Demeter has anything like the stature that Yavanna has in Greek mythology, but they're at least kind of the same in that they're both focused on the same kind of stuff. But after that, we really don't get a whole lot of direct one-to-one comparisons, and you'll see what I mean. Perhaps the nearest thing to a one-to-one connection is Hestia. And Hestia is one who is sometimes not associated with the Olympians. So there's, according to Wikipedia, her and I don't remember the other one, might have been Ares, not always counted among the main gods. But Hestia is kind of the goddess of hearth and home. And there's not really a Valar who is a Vala who is really just directly connected to that idea, but you do get Este, who is kind of like that, because her main thing is rest, recovery, healing, that sort of thing, although there's connections with other Greek gods in some of those. But Hestia is maybe the closest thing to that because hearth and home is very much where you do your resting and recuperating. That's, you know, it makes a lot of sense to kind of connect those two in that way, but it's not very direct at all. So that's, you know, kind of close, but we're starting to get really far apart here. Not that we were ever one to one. Aulë and Hephaestus are another that are close, but again, not exactly one to one. The sense in which they're very directly connected is that they're both craftsmen. They make stuff. But, and this is kind of like the Ulmo Poseidon comparison, Aulë is really about substances. He made the stuff of Arda. Hephaestus didn't do that. In Greek mythology, Gaia, the earth, already existed before, you know, any of these gods did. And so he's not the guy who made everything. And I will say there is a certain amount of similarity in terms of their attitude, I guess you might say. Hephaestus seems to have been a fairly up-and-up god as far as the Greek gods go. The Greek gods are famously very fickle and, you know, envious and mean and just Hephaestus at least seems to have been kind of on the up and up in terms of there's a story where he actually tries to tell Zeus about him being cheated on, or he confronts Zeus about him cheating on Hera. I forget which it is. So there's a sense in which he's kind of like fighting for the right side in a dispute. And Aulë has something similar going on in his creation of the dwarves where, you know, he kind of lets his own impatience run away with him, but when Ilúvatar kind of confronts him about it, he's like, you're right, I'm sorry, I'll take that back. So there's kind of a connection there, maybe in a way, but it's really, really loose. And again, Aulë being like Hephaestus, mainly about crafting things, for Aulë, that's kind of secondary to the fact that he's all about the physical substance. It's not so much that he's a craftsman and therefore he likes substances. No, he built all the substances and that's why he's into crafts. Hephaestus is just all about the crafts, really. But Hephaestus is also the god of volcanoes, which is why, you know, in like Latin, he's Vulcan. So, but you know, that's a very particular thing, whereas Aulë is all about, you know, like rocks, gems, earth, all of it. It's like, it's all Aulis. Hephaestus is just about the volcano, which, if you think about it, makes him specifically connected because it's kind of a forge, which might be more of a Sauron connection. But we'll just look over that for a moment. All right, now we're definitely out of direct comparison territory here. We have some others that are similar, and coming back to Vyrhe, like I mentioned, we have her, and she is basically a seamstress. She is weaving the web of the story of Arda constantly. She's basically writing the history of it in a tapestry, which goes on the halls of Mondos. And that's where she kind of gets the connection with the Fates that I mentioned earlier. But there's really no Greek god that directly matches up with this. It's just not a thing. And, you know, another example of this would be Tulkas. Tulkas is, he's the guy who's the strongest and does the biggest deeds of prowess. And that's, you know, he's also a happy wrestler. The closest comparison you can get really with him is Ares, who is the god of war. But Ares is just a mean, brutal dude. He is not a happy wrestler. And he's really more about just war outright. He's got a lot of bloodlust, which is why he ends up being a villain in a lot of DC comics. Ares is also kind of comparable to Eonwe, who is said to be, you know, no one in Arda is greater in might of arms than Eonwe. Orome also has some kind of connection to Ares, because Orome is kind of like the cavalry of the Valar. I mean, he goes back to Middle-earth before the elves arrive, and he's constantly kind of making war on the monsters of Morgoth. And Orome is kind of warlike, although he's not really inherently a warlike, you know, Vala. That's, you know, he's one of the closest things to that. So, I mean, we got a lot of, like, different kinds of connections here between these different Valar and, you know, Ares. Orome is also all about trees and hunting and that sort of thing. And in that regard, he is kind of like Artemis, who is the goddess of the hunt. But Artemis is also associated with deer and purity and that sort of thing. And that seems a little bit more like Nessa, who is a runner and kind of associated with animals. And so again, we're starting to get into this territory where you can point to one thing here and one thing there, but I mean, there's connections to all these different characters for one character on one side. And it gets, you know, really interesting to look at some of that. We also have Nienna, who is basically the Vala of sorrow and grief and pity. And that's just not a thing in the Greek pantheon, which you can kind of understand, right? I mean, the Greek pantheon is mostly about either elemental things like lightning and water, or it's about something that is just very important in life, like, again, growing crops or war making, which is just a part of your life if you live in the ancient world, all this kind of stuff. You can see why the Greeks wouldn't necessarily think to themselves, you know what, we need a god who cries. So that's really not a thing. Tolkien's doing this, I think, more out of that, again, Christian background, where sorrow and the aspects of sorrow that kind of play into the world makes a lot more sense from that Christian point of view, because the fall creates a lot of sorrowful stuff, which God has to come in and fix. That's not how the Greeks view the world. So it makes sense that they're not going to have that kind of thing going on. We also have Vana, who is really just associated with flowers and birds. And in that sense, she, you know, the flowers, you could kind of connect her with Demeter a little bit, but Demeter is more about food growing and that kind of thing. And there's really just not a direct connection, I don't think, for Vana. Vana seems to be more about just kind of the beauty of nature in a lot of ways, but not, anything really in particular. It's also interesting that Vana is associated with birds and flowers when birds are also kind of Manwë's thing, especially eagles, but birds in general. So, kind of interesting that they have an overlap, but she doesn't really have much of an overlap with the Greek pantheon. Lorien is associated with dreams and visions. The closest thing you can come to with this in the Greek pantheon would be Apollo, who is the god of the sun, but also the god of prophecy. He's also associated with archery, music, dance, light, poetry. Apollo has a lot of different connections, and his connection with poetry makes him kind of like Manwë in a way. His connection with prophecy is what kind of connects him with Lorien, because visions and dreams can be associated with the idea of prophetic foretelling and that sort of thing, but it's not necessarily the same thing. It can be that the visions and dreams are just something to encourage you in the moment. So that's, you know, not necessarily the same thing, but it's at least a sort of connection. Also, interestingly, the Valar have no, you know, major characters for the sun and the moon. And by the way, Artemis, I mentioned earlier, is connected with the moon, because they end up, you know, the stars are connected with Varda, but the sun and moon are like lesser sub-things that weren't really meant to be from the start, and so they get handed off to, you know, Maiar, who are the lesser sort of demigods. And of course that would be Arion and Tilion, and those, you know, are connected kind of in that way to Apollo and Artemis. But, you know, again, it shows kind of the difference in how Tolkien is setting things up. The Greeks, of course, would look at the sun and the moon, and they're these big bright lights in the sky. Of course they're important, right? Well, Tolkien's like, ah, forget that. The stars are prettier. And so they're the main thing, and not so much the sun and the moon. They come later, and they're less important. So, you know, again, it's about how you tell the myth. Athena in Greek mythology is the kind of the goddess of wisdom, which would be kind of a Manwë thing, maybe. But she's also the goddess of warfare, which is more of a, you know, kind of a Tulkas slash Eonwë slash Orome thing. She is also connected with handicraft, kind of like Hephaestus, but not exactly the same. Hephaestus is more smithing. I think Athena is a little less focused than that. Artemis I've already talked about, but she is also connected with, I think I mentioned purity earlier, I mean specifically chastity, which makes her kind of the opposite of Aphrodite, who is the goddess of love and passion and things that come with that, and there's really nothing like that in the Valar. And again, you can see why. Again, the Greeks are looking at stuff and going, you know, we've got these really basic things that are just part of life. We got to connect them to deities somehow. And yes, you know, love and reproduction is part of life, but it's not, you know, Tolkien kind of puts all that in the realm of Eru Iluvatar, because Eru is the one who makes man, and he's the one who gives life. None of the Valar associated with life per se, because that's really uniquely Eru's thing. But the Greeks don't have a, you know, single monotheistic god who's above everything else, and so they've got to come up with their own, you know, one of the pantheon who kind of handles that aspect of things. Hermes is one of the more interesting ones. He's the god who is kind of the messenger of the gods, but he's also connected with thieves, orators. He is connected with travelers and merchants. He's kind of a grab bag in a lot of ways, but it's the one thing they kind of all have in common is that they can trick you. And Hermes is a bit of a trickster. You know, orators can trick you with their flowery language. Merchants can trick you by, you know, putting their thumb on the scale. You know, the thieves, all this sort of thing. Hermes is kind of the trickster god a little bit. And there really isn't one of those in the Valar. You know, you might associate him with Morgoth in that sense because of the dishonesty, I guess. But I'm not counting Morgoth. Morgoth is just the bad guy. And none of these in the Greek pantheon are really the bad guy, although they all have their problems. But you know, Hermes is just in one way, his sort of playfulness, and a lot of it is kind of playfulness, you could almost connect with Tulkas because he's the one who's just kind of happy-go-lucky, but it's really not the same thing. I think I forgot to mention Nessa, who is the spouse of Orome and associated with running and deer, and in this regard, she is kind of like Artemis, but not specifically exactly, so there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And it kind of makes sense that she's paired with Orome because he likes to hunt and he likes woods. So, you know, they kind of go together well in a almost incompatible sort of way. But, yeah, her closest connection in the Greek pantheon would be Artemis. But that's, you know, and it between the two of them, Orome and Nessa, they actually fill up a lot of Artemis's, you know, sphere, so to speak. But in, like I said, in kind of a weirdly incompatible way. Orome likes hunting. Nessa likes the things that are hunted. Artemis is kind of both, which is kind of weird. Finally, we get to Dionysius, and this might have been the other one who was sometimes in, sometimes out of the Olympians. Dionysius is interesting. A lot of the time what we think of in terms of him, and he's also called Bacchus, so if you're not familiar with one name, you might know the other. We tend to think of him mainly as like the god of wine and lots of imbibing of wine. But he's also connected with religious ecstasy, fertility, festivity, orchards and fruit. And in this way, he's kind of connected to Yavanna a little bit. But he's also connected with insanity and theater. And you can kind of see how all these things go together. Like, wine can make you a little crazy, and the theater, you know, actors can be crazy. There's not exactly a stereotype, but there's an idea going way back that actors are, you know, a little kooky, and actors have always, for the most part, up until very recent times, actually been kind of looked down on as a different, you know, and not so, you know, honorable profession. I don't know if that's really the case in the Greek, you know, culture, but, you know, there's certainly some idea of connection between all of these things a little bit. You know, the fertility and the fruits and orchards, of course, are what lead to wine, and the wine and the drunkenness is kind of what's connected to the religious ecstasy, insanity, and all this other stuff. But there's really nothing like this in the Valar. You know, the closest thing maybe you could think of would be Lorien because of the visions and dreams. But again, that's really loose. So I think that pretty much covers everybody. And again, like I said earlier, I'm going to talk about kind of a general overview look at this. The interesting thing here is that on the one hand, they seem like they ought to be very similar because both of them, both groups, seem to have this focus on, you know, kind of accounting for all things in creation, right? But they're also very different in how they go about that. And on the one hand, Tolkien almost seems more focused on the elemental, even though it seems like that would be more of a Greek thing. Because, like I mentioned with Aule and Ulmo versus Hephaestus and Poseidon, those two in the Valar are very connected to the actual substance, the stuff, you know, the water and the physical things in the earth, whereas Poseidon and Hephaestus are really more just like, I rule over the realm that is the seas, and Hephaestus is just really the craftsman, but also associated with volcanoes. But on the other hand, there's things about the Valar that are not really all that elemental. The stars are not exactly elemental. Dreams and visions are not exactly elemental. You know, they're not just accounting for the things that make up the world. And in some ways, the Greek pantheon does that a little bit more. So, you know, like lightning is a much more elemental thing in one way than the wind. Because the wind is just kind of like stuff moving. The wind is not really any different than the air. So, in what way is Manwë really about anything in particular? It's kind of weird. Zeus, though, you know, when you in the ancient world at least, lightning was seen as this thing, and it was a very much an elemental thing that you would worry about and hope to goodness that Zeus wasn't going to strike you down with. But, you know, there's differences in how both groups handle some of that stuff, but both of them diverge off of the elemental stuff. They both have, you know, connections with things that grow out of the ground. They both have, you know, people who rule the houses of the dead, and they both have, you know, rulers who kind of are over all the rest of them. But the Greeks don't have one for the stars like Varda. They don't have, you know, somebody like Tulkas, who is all about strength but isn't about war. You know, Ares is just about war, not so much strength itself. Tulkas, in that way, is kind of more like Hercules, who's just literally famous for his strength, and in, you know, especially bare hand combat. Whereas that's, you know, Hercules is a demigod in the Greek mythology and doesn't really end up in the pantheon. He ends up in Olympus, but only as an afterthought after he's gone through all of his earthly life. So it's really interesting to compare and contrast because they both do similar things in that they both kind of try to cover the elemental aspects, but also diverge from that in a lot of ways. Like I said, though, the Greeks, they really seem to be focused on accounting for the things that make up the world and life in general. So, you know, Aphrodite is the goddess of love, beauty, and, you know, reproduction, let's just say. Whereas that's not really the case in the Valar, because the Valar don't have that. Because again, some stuff is handled purely by Eru Iluvatar alone. And the Valar therefore seem more like they're accounting for, you know, the things that make up the world, but also you have, you know, like Lorien, who is kind of in charge of dreams and visions. You have Vyrae, who is just kind of recording everything, and then you have Nienna, who's just sad about everything. And they all play their roles, although it's not clear what role exactly Nienna plays, it has to be said, other than in maybe teaching other people, like, say, Gandalf when he's Olorin, about pity. And in that way, the perspective of the Valar is a very different kind of thing. It's not just about how do we explain life? Well, not quite. The Valar are seemingly more about, yeah, how can we say that these people are connected with the things in the world, but also what role do they play in human or elvish moral development, maybe? Because really that's kind of what Nienna is all about. Mondos even is in some ways about that, because with the elves at least, Mondos kind of has to decide how long you're going to stay here. You know, Hades doesn't really make those kinds of decisions. Once you're in and you're not getting out. That's just the way that works. So it's a very different kind of thing there. And there's really no connection in the Greek pantheon to this idea of morality. Zeus has the law and order aspect of it, but law and order can be imposed without it being particularly moral. Whereas you get the very distinct sense with the Valar that, you know, there is a right way to go about things, not just an orderly way to go about things. The Greek gods, also, like I mentioned before about one or two of them, they seem to have this kind of scattershot stuff, like Poseidon being associated with horses, because it wasn't, like I said, a systematic theology. Tolkien is coming up with all this stuff off of his own imagination, and so he can kind of impose from the beginning a more orderly, you know, set of this is what this character's associated with, this is what this character's associated with. Whereas the Greeks, they have kind of a hodgepodge because all of their theology, if we want to call it that, it didn't really come from like one source, like say the Bible. You know, it was very much like a ground up type of thing that all got amalgamated. And so it's a very different kind of thing from that perspective too. But we can see how both, in some ways, do a lot of the same stuff. You know, we got to account for the physical things in the earth. We've got to account for phenomena like lightning. We've got to account for, you know, phenomena like religious ecstasy, which is, you know, something like that occurs in the world, whether you believe it's real or not. And you have to account for all these things, and it's, you know, the Greek idea of it was, well, let's see, this is really important, and it happens. We have to explain it. Tolkien's, because he's working from kind of first principles and working down, and he has a more monotheistic thing going on in the Silmarillion, is more worried about, you know, I'm going to set up this pantheon, as it were, and it's going to be kind of like this Greek pantheon, but it's going to be a lot more focused, and it's going to be about what I want it to be about. So, yeah, Tolkien was clearly influenced by things like the Greek pantheon and probably the Norse pantheon and some others, maybe as well. But clearly, he took it his own direction, and it's obvious that he was influenced in some ways by those, but he's doing a very different kind of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of connections, a lot of differences, a lot of similarities. You could pick out a lot of different things, but I don't want to belabor the video anymore at this point. It's pretty long already, so I'll just call it here. And if anybody else wants to throw in their own two cents about what's interesting about connections, differences, all that kind of stuff, throw them in the comments below. Again, this was in response to a request by Patreon patron Robert Kindling, so thank him for the video idea if you found this interesting. And if you did, please do give it a thumbs up, share it around, follow me on any of my various platforms. Links are in the description below. If you're on YouTube, make sure you click the bell icon if you subscribe to make sure you don't miss any notifications. Follow me on the platform formerly known as Twitter to get regular Tolkien-related trivia questions. And check the description for support and social links as well. Until the next time, I'm the Tolkien Geek, signing out for the Tolkien Lore Channel. Namarie! Thanks to all my channel supporters, especially Paul Leone, Nathan Dufour, and Robert Kindling.